the other leaker of the Pentagon Papers.
So he went to work for RAND, and he was sent to Vietnam as part of one of their studies. It was a motivation and morale study, and he was supposed to figure out why the North Vietnamese kept fighting and what they were in it for and what their how they thought about the war. And the things he saw and the things he found out and the prisoners he talked to really radicalized him. I mean, he'd been kind of radical to begin with, but really he was deeply disturbed by what happened to him in Vietnam. So when he came back, he wanted to do something about it. And as luck would have it, one of his friends, or maybe perhaps one of his only friends at RAND, was Daniel Ellsberg. And at some point, Ellsberg said, I have all these papers. I have this U.S. government report that says that the U.S. government has been lying to the American people about Vietnam and why we were there and so forth. And Tony helped encourage him to leak it.
That's author Francine Prose talking about Tony Russo. Her new book, 1974, is about their friendship when she was in her 20s and about the year when something in the zeitgeist was ending and something else beginning. Then we talk with acclaimed author Gail Godwin about her new book, Getting to Know Death, A Meditation. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Francine Prose is a prolific writer, the author of 20 novels, 3 short story collections, 10 nonfiction books, and even a children's book. She's one of America's most eminent writers, a former president of Penn American Center, and a visiting professor of literature at Bard College. Now, at the age of 77, she's come out with her first memoir, looking back at a pivotal time in her life and in the nation's, the early 1970s. The year before her memoir, 1974, begins, she had already published her first novel. Francine Prose's memoir recounts a time when she lived in San Francisco, a hub of the counterculture, the sexual revolution, and of activism against the war in Vietnam, and the place that one of the heroes of that anti-war struggle, Tony Russo, came to stay after spending time in prison for helping Daniel Ellsberg release the Pentagon Papers. Prose recounts her friendship with Russo, who took her for long nighttime drives around San Francisco while he told her about working for the RAND Corporation in Vietnam and the evil of the U.S. war against that tiny nation, an experience that deeply traumatized him. 1974 is also about how the optimism of the 1960s gave way to the disillusion of the 70s, as a generation's hopes for radical change were blasted to pieces by the forces of reaction. 50 years later, Prose's memoir not only captures a personal journey, but also offers a vivid portrait of a transformative period in American history. Prose's reflections on activism, personal identity, and the evolution of social norms resonate deeply, making 1974 a compelling narrative of a time with enduring relevance to our own. Francine Prose, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much. It's so good to be here.
So this is the first memoir I've read by you, although there was Reading Like a Writer, which I guess in a way was a memoir. Is that right?
Well, yeah. I mean, in the sense that Reading Like a Writer started as lectures I had to give at various, usually summer writers' conferences. So Reading Like a Writer, each of the chapters usually started with some sort of personal anecdote. But the difference between an anecdote and a memoir is pretty big. So this is the first, you know, and I've written about trips that our family took and so forth and so on. But this is the first sustained piece of memoir that I've done.
And it covers the time that you lived in San Francisco between 1972 and 1975, focusing on 1974, which was a year that you met Tony Russo, who we'll get into in a moment. But I want to ask you first, you say that you knew that year that your life and the world around you was changing, that something was ending, something else beginning. But at the time, you were too inside of it to have any idea what it was. That's such an interesting thing, to have the sense that things are changing. Now, after all these 50 years later, what was changing?
Well, I think the spirit of the times was changing. I mean, one of the things that I talk about in the book is how is what the 60s were like. I mean, all the kind of hopefulness and idealism and the idea that we could change things for the better, the war in Vietnam could end, there would be less income inequality, less racism, et cetera. And then by about, well, in the early 70s, certainly by 1974, we began to notice that that was not going to happen. I mean, Watergate was happening, the Patty Hearst kidnapping, which I talk about in the book, confirmed a lot of people in their ideas that radicals or progressives, as we call them now, were just a bunch of thugs kidnapping this rich white girl. So the tide of the country was changing. And also, I think as people in my generation were beginning to get a little older and beginning to realize that they wanted jobs and careers and families and so forth, and were more drawn towards stability, that some of those ideals were sacrificed.
And of course, that speeded up in the 1980s. You know, recently, my granddaughter is 20, and she and her boyfriend have been involved with the protests at CUNY over Gaza. And she asked me, what was it like in Colombia? And, you know, 1968, I mean, I didn't go to Colombia, but I was a New Yorker, so I knew it was happening. And I was in SDS, Students for a Democratic Society. And I told her, I said, you know, back then, I remember telling my stepfather that a revolution was going to happen in 10 years. And I said, and now it's a long time later, the revolution hasn't happened. So you have to understand that this is a long game that we're fighting.
Yeah, a very, very, very long game, as it's turned out. No, I mean, I think that there was some idea that, you know, as you said, in 10 years' time, we'd be changing jobs and working in rice paddies for part of the year, and medical care would be free, and there would be doctors who went from town to town and so forth. And quite the opposite was happening. But, you know, the long game was also being played by the people who had the most to gain from none of this happening. I mean, the Koch brothers, for example, were already busy figuring out how money could be made from environmental disaster, let's say. And Nixon was in the White House, so something had happened there. And the Reagan-Bush years were just about to happen. So, you know, and there were, I mean, there were things going on, the Iran-Contra scandal and so forth, to make sure that Jimmy Carter couldn't, his presidency couldn't survive. So there was, as you say, there was a revolution, but it wasn't, excuse me, it wasn't the one that we were hoping or expecting.
So you lived with a couple who knew Tony Russo and introduced you to him. Tell us about him, who he was, and how he was involved with the release of the Pentagon Papers with Daniel Ellsberg.
Well, he was trained as an aeronautical space engineer, and then he became a data analyst and security analyst and so forth. And he decided, as many people thought back then, that one of the ways to bring about change was to work in the so-called belly of the beast. I mean, that is, if he went to work for the RAND Corporation to use his analytical skills with them, that he would be close to the center of power. I mean, the RAND Corporation was very involved with the U.S. military, was very involved with what was happening in Vietnam. So he went to work for RAND, and he was sent to Vietnam as part of one of their studies. It was a motivation and morale study. And he was supposed to figure out why the North Vietnamese kept fighting and what they were in it for and how they thought about the war. And the things he saw and the things he found out and the prisoners he talked to really radicalized him. I mean, he'd been kind of radical to begin with, but really he was deeply disturbed by what happened to him in Vietnam. So when he came back, he wanted to do something about it. And as luck would have it, one of his friends, or maybe perhaps one of his only friends at RAND, was Daniel Ellsberg. And at some point, Ellsberg said, "I have all these papers. I have this U.S. government report that says that the U.S. government has been lying to the American people about Vietnam and why we were there and so forth." And Tony helped encourage him to leak it. He said, "Let's, I know someone who has a Xerox machine. Let's just get it out there." I mean, one of the touching things to me, or moving things really, was how at that time, what, half a century ago, people believed, certainly Tony believed and Ellsberg believed, that if people knew that the government was lying, that they would be so shocked they would want to do something about it and change the government or change the world or something. And now, of course, government lying is just a joke. I mean, we don't even take it very seriously anymore because it's so widespread.
And say a little bit more, tell us a little bit more about him as you knew him.
Yeah. Well, by the time I met him, he went to jail, and Ellsberg didn't. He went to jail because he refused to testify unless it was in an open court, because he wanted to turn the hearing or trial or whatever into a lesson about Vietnam that people could get a hold of and see and hear. So, and he was very idealistic. I mean, he was very radical. He was clearly a little unbalanced. He was extremely intense. And, there were many things about him which made him less socially acceptable than Ellsberg, who was handsome and had great suits and beautiful haircut and so forth. So gradually, I think Tony was kind of edged out of the story of the Pentagon Papers because even the language he used, capitalism, imperialism, so forth, was not the language that more moderates wanted to use about him.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with writer Francine Prose, novelist and essayist and now memoirist. Her latest book is 1974, and it is a memoir. I want to come back to some of this, but first, tell us a little bit about your relationship with him, because this is also a really fascinating part of the story. I felt like I was inside your head a lot in this book because you really describe, almost moment by moment, your shifting responses to him and checking your own, how you're coming across to him. Of course, things that we all recognize, when we were young or even older, how are we coming across to this person that we're attracted to?
Yeah, well, I was inside my head a lot, as you can tell. I mean, so much of the book for me is about being young and about the kind of risky choices or shaky sense of identity or a lack of sort of solid core that happens when you're young, especially to young women, I think. So I wanted, I was just someone to listen to him, really. I mean, our so-called relationship was mostly just him driving around very fast in the middle of the night in San Francisco and talking and talking and talking, mostly talking about Vietnam, talking about politics and so forth. And I was listening and remembering. I mean, I had no thought of writing about it at the time, but just remembering what he said. And also, I mean, there's a line early in the book in which I say something about that I was shocked by how quickly a conversation about me had turned into a conversation about him. So he really, I mean, he liked the idea of, I already had two novels or one novel published and another about to come out. So he liked the idea of being with a writer, of hanging out with a writer, because he was trying to write a book. But he never asked me to read what he was writing, and he never really asked me very much about myself. But that was really okay with me at the time. I mean, I really was just interested, I was just this ear, just interested in what he was saying and in what was happening. And because it was so odd, and he was so idealistic and so reckless in a way that it was enthralling. I mean, also he was famous, he was still kind of famous as an anti-war activist. So the fact that I was still very young, and this famous anti-war activist like me or something was again very, very attractive.
And it's kind of more the old something. I mean, he didn't seem to be romantically interested. He didn't seem to be interested in a romantic relationship. What was he looking for?
I don't know. I really don't know. All these years later, I mean, I think he was looking for. First of all, I think he was looking for someone to listen to him. Second of all, I think because he'd, lost his various jobs after he was in jail and was writing a book, I think he was looking for evidence that you could make a life as a writer, that you didn't have to work for the Rand Corporation, that you didn't have to be a statistical analyst, that you could write. So I think that actually was important to him, although it rarely came up. And also, I think he was looking for company and friendship and another human being in that car, which I think we're all looking for.
Now, he seems pretty disturbed. I mean, mentally disturbed. And in fact, even before you mentioned it in the book, it struck me that he was really suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. Talk about where that stemmed from and how that colored. I mean, he had a certain kind of paranoia, but was it really paranoia? He thought that he was being followed, but he had, after all, been targeted and persecuted by the U.S. government. So talk about his mental instability and its roots in reality.
Well, yeah. I mean, he had been targeted and persecuted, and he had, I mean, I believed him when he said that the garbage men were still dumping his garbage all over the alley in his house in L.A. I mean, there was a lot of, because passions were ran very high about the war. So he was, as an anti-war hero, there were people who were very strongly for him and people who were very strongly against him. And also the surveillance systems that were in place. I mean, I had a friend who was a very prominent member of the Black Panthers, and she talked a lot about COINTELPRO and the way in which, in her case, the FBI had really persecuted the Panthers and made sure that some of them died and others went to jail. So all those so-called paranoias of Tony's had a certain basis of reality, but then what happened was that it kind of turned a corner. I mean, and I didn't notice until it had really, really changed. I mean, when it really hit me was we had met again in New York City. He'd come to New York. I'd gone home to New York, and we were crossing 7th Avenue, and he just sort of waded out into traffic, and this taxi almost hit him. And then he said, "Well, didn't you notice that that taxi was being driven by the Secretary of Defense?" And he tried to kill me. And it was pretty clear to me that the taxi had not been driven by the Secretary of Defense. And I thought, uh-oh, I mean, things have, as I said, taken a turn, and they proceeded to get worse over the next couple of days.
So he also talks about his boss at Rand, who he calls Dr. Strangelove, of course, referencing the great movie by Stanley Kubrick about Dr. Strangelove, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. It's really chilling to read about this boss. This was at the Rand Corporation, as I said. Tell us about Dr. Strangelove.
Well, it's based on a real person whose name I've just been avoiding, but I think there were a lot of guys like that, guys who'd gone into the CIA, guys who were theoretically working for Rand or some other think tank, and who just were power mad the way Peter Sellers is in the Stanley Kubrick movie, and unhinged the way. So it was clear, I think, to Tony that there was a lot of crazy stuff going on, but also the boss was telling the military, because as I said, the military and Rand were very closely allied, was telling the military what they wanted to hear, which was, we need more soldiers, we need more bombs, we need more war, it has to last longer, we're going to win. All of these things were not true. And the research that Tony did there, they published a report which was just full of lies, which was the opposite of what he'd said. I mean, they had him cover the defoliation program and so forth. And they just distorted what he'd said because it wasn't evidence on their side for what they were saying needed to be done. And of course, all the things they were saying that needed to be done, more bombing, more this, more that, were not working and were never going to work. And Tony knew that. So I think it was beyond frustrating to try and breathe in that atmosphere where so much real evil was being done in the name of patriotism.
Yes, evil is the word. And when you say defoliation program, I mean, I knew about the defoliation program back then, but it wasn't until I read this memoir, Francine Prose, your memoir, 1974, that I understood really what that defoliation meant. He described to you what happened to the fields, that this was a program of destroying food crops. It wasn't really just a program of destroying tree cover of enemy troops.
Yeah, I mean, the ultimate aim was starvation. I mean, the idea was if the villages were starved and punished, sufficiently punished, that they would stop sheltering and stop supporting the North Vietnamese fighters. So it was very punitive and terrifying. I mean, sidebar, right now we have, I don't know about you, but we have this plague of caterpillars that's eating all the trees. And I thought just how, you know, it's nothing like what happened in Vietnam, but I thought of the terror when suddenly people must have felt when suddenly there were these just broken bare trees and it had come from spraying poisons and using fire, you know, weapons.
And of course, those poisons continue to cause terrible wreckage in, you know, with birth defects in Vietnam.
And here, and with the soldiers that came back, Agent Orange was, you know, I mean, I think it went through the generations. So, yeah.
So I want to go back to the zeitgeist, the spirit of the times, as you talked about. You know, this was a time of the counterculture. You write in this memoir that freedom was the whole lesson of the counterculture. I think actually you might be quoting somebody else in that. But that freedom, that first of all, I want you to talk about what did freedom mean to us?
Well, the early 1960s were basically the 50s. So all the thing, I mean, and particularly women's lives, let's say, all the things that people like Betty Friedan had railed against, you know, the idea that a woman's destiny was to be a mother and a housewife and support her man and so forth, were still very much in place. And then second wave feminism came along in the 60s and 70s and said, no, we have a whole different view of how women's lives should be. And we're going to not go along with that program. And then there, you know, the idea of sort of class mobility was around, sexual freedom. You could sleep with anyone you wanted without having any consequences wrong. You know, and a number of ideas about again, liberation. I mean, self-liberation, a wider social liberation. And also, the white radicals were much more likely to work together with black radicals than they are now, certainly. I mean, there's not this, the same tensions weren't in play then.
Yeah, there was the Young Patriots in Chicago and the Young Lords in New York and the Black Panthers. And it was also a time when identity politics was not really separate from class politics in many ways.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, again, because there was this idea that all the divisions and separations and meaningless rules and domination by the powerful, et cetera, could be transcended or cast off, and new ways of being and living could be devised that were more equitable and more satisfying to people. But that, you know, then, well, there was capitalism. We kind of didn't, I don't think we were quite aware of how powerful that was.
Right. And I actually think that's something that has changed from that time. Of course, at that time, I was aware of it because I was a Marxist. And I mean that in the sense of somebody who had, you know, studied Das Kapital, all three volumes, and kind of that's where I cut my teeth on understanding the world, understanding that it very much had to do with power relationships that were based on on class and on the economic, the relationships of production, as we would call it.
Well, you know, Marx had one thing very right and one thing very wrong. I mean, the right thing was, to put it crudely, follow the money. You know, I was just reading in the New Yorker an article about the CIA and how they'd managed to overthrow all these governments around the world and so forth. And it didn't really mention the economic aspect of the, I mean, it was more about the drive for power and control, which was certainly there. But the reason that Henry Kissinger supported the coup in Chile, which overthrew Allende, which was because Allende was going to nationalize the mines, which was going to radically cut into the profit of American ownership and so forth. So, and that was true in a lot of places. I mean, every time it seemed like a leader who's a little too far to the left would be installed, and then our government, the CIA, whatever, would say, well, the guy's bad for business, essentially, and make sure that the person was overthrown, which turned out to be much worse, of course, in every case.
Exactly. And that's really what I mean. And that's where I understood that the foundation is follow the money.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what he had wrong was human nature. I mean, the idea that you would just willingly give up any idea of private property and so forth. I mean, what happened in the Soviet Union was evidence of excuse me, how inaccurate that was. I mean, the party leaders wanted mink coats and the best caviar and so forth, and they were not going to give it up. So he overestimated, I think, people's capabilities.
Yeah, and in that, I think he was very much of a 19th century movement in general. I mean, Marx was not the only one who was idealistic about abolishing property relationships. But Francine Prose, the other part of this that I found so interesting was your discussion of sexual freedom, because I really had to think about it. This was, after all, a time, as you say, coming out of the 1960s, where women were still being treated in a very demeaning manner. I mean, after all, in your first novel, when you met the publisher, he said to you, "You didn't write this whole book all by yourself, did you?"
Yeah, I know. He hadn't learned. I mean, since then, men have mostly learned you're not supposed to say stuff like that. And yeah, I mean, that was a horrifying moment, because I just kind of giggled in a way, like, you know, some girl. And I knew what he'd said, and I knew why he'd said it. So it was horrifying.
Right. And yet, that kind of sexual freedom that we had as young women, this was a time before AIDS, before, you know, the HIV epidemic. You describe it so accurately. Talk about the sexual freedom that women felt and how liberating that was, and also maybe some of the contradictions in it.
Well, it was the sweet spot, so to speak, between the pill and AIDS. So somehow you could have sex and you wouldn't get pregnant and you wouldn't die from it. So that was, you know, sort of a brief period of when that was possible. And then there was this idea, you know, that you could sleep with anyone you wanted, that it didn't mean a real commitment, that marriage was completely old-fashioned and a useless institution and so forth. But I think people had a lot of illusions about sex and the consequences. I mean, the idea that there was jealousy, that there was possessiveness, that people got their feelings hurt, was somehow not factored into the idea of sexual freedom and complete freedom. And I mean, it was at once liberating and in a funny way dehumanizing, because it encouraged you not to see the full range of the human being you were having sex with. I mean, it's different now, you know, now with hookup culture. When I read young women writing about it, it's odd, because there's a kind of, you know, I can hook up with one night with somebody I meet online and it's not a big problem. But then there's a kind of, I keep reading and sensing a kind of almost puritanical guilt that creeps in, which we didn't have. I mean, we really did not, as far as I remember, we didn't have guilt about, you know, we often didn't have guilt, which we should have had. I mean, I slept with a friend's husband. I should have, you know, I feel guilty about it, more guilty about it now than I did then.
Right. And also, I think we live in a time where women are supposed to be liberated. And there's so many contradictory messages that are coming at young women. You have to be super sexy. There's this whole kind of rape culture that on the one hand, and then on the other hand, women are supposed to be, you know, bold and brave and take on the world.
Yeah. I mean, my granddaughter's 17 and she and her friends, they don't wear any clothes. They go out in like, you know, these little shorts, midriffs, and they're beautiful. I mean, and why shouldn't they be proud of their bodies? But I keep thinking, boy, there's a tough world out there. Just learn to be careful because.
So I wonder if you could read, I actually found the last page in this book so beautiful and so true. I think you might have to set it up a little bit.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that runs through the book is the Hitchcock film Vertigo, which I was and continue to be obsessed with, partly because it's set in San Francisco. I mean, it was a very different San Francisco from, the late 50s, very different San Francisco from the one that I was living in the early 1970s. But the whole kind of romance of the city was just suffused that film. And also because the film was about obsession, which was a subject very dear to my heart. I mean, it was partly, I think, why I was drawn to Tony, because he was so obsessed. And so the very various, and as I say in the book, I mean, I've probably seen the film like 15 times since then, and each time it means something different to me, and I have a very different experience. But so the last page, there's a, I teach at Bard College, and there was this wonderful performance where they got a live orchestra to play the Bernard Herrmann score to Vertigo and showed Vertigo on a big screen. I mean, it was really unforgettable. It was incredible. And for some reason, I decided to take my granddaughters. One was 10 and one was 6. And I don't know, I knew they would get it. And as it turned out, they really did. I mean, I don't know if they remember, but I knew that at the time they could follow the plot, they would know, you know. And I thought, well, you know, this experience of seeing it with a live orchestra, maybe they're not going to get a chance to do that again. So I got tickets for the two of them and my daughter-in-law and myself, and we all went. And my middle granddaughter, who at that point was 6, is named Milena. I think that's all you need to know. In the second half of the film, during the scene in which Scotty first sees Madeline and Judy and wants to believe that he hasn't lost the woman he loves, that she has come back from the dead, I was startled when Milena asked me what was wrong. Why was I crying? I hadn't realized I was crying. I couldn't answer. I didn't know. I'd been thinking about how much of the film was about driving around San Francisco. I guess the movie's sad, I said. Duh, Milena said. Then she added sweetly, don't cry, to make sure that I knew she loved me. I think that was when I realized that at some point I would write about San Francisco, about 1974, about that year when so much changed, that year when the city looked like it did in Vertigo, even though it didn't. I think it was then that I knew I would try to describe those nights when the neon striped Tony's windshield, when the neighborhood seemed haunted, when the bay seemed deep and dark, the bridge dangerously high, the time when Patty Hearst and her captors blackened the windows of their safe house, when Herrmann's score soared and pulsed beneath the Delphonics, If You Don't Know Me By Now. I think I knew that someday I would write about another time when another war was being fought on a distant continent, in the past that keeps returning like a recurring dream, a time so different, so almost unimaginable, so unlike the present moment, the best I can do is write. Maybe that was who I was. Maybe this is what happened. Now, I realized having read this that there are two that there are two lies in here. I mean, one is that time was very much like the present moment. I mean, I see all these parallels between that moment of thinking that things were really going down the dumper very fast with the way I feel now. So, you know, that's lie number one. And then also, it wasn't exactly then that I decided to write about. I mean, it was a little while after, and I was just taking a walk up here with a friend of mine, and I, for some reason, I can't remember what brought it up, but I told her the whole story about Tony and so on. And she said, "You should write about that." And I said, "Oh, what a good idea." And I started, and the first version was just about him. And I mean, it was called Whistleblower. And then my editor and publisher convinced me to sort of broaden it to actually put myself in the story, which I did. So that's kind of how it evolved from there.
And actually, this struck me too. I mean, that is a beautiful last page. And I had the same reaction at the end. I said, but I also feel, after having read 1974, this wonderful book, Francine Prose, I also felt the parallels to today are absolutely striking. And if anything, the cruelty of the system that was exposed by Tony Russo is even more exposed today. We see it on the news every day. I mean, we were doing a genocide then, and we're supporting a genocide now.
Exactly. We've supported several genocides since. Yeah, I know. No, absolutely. And also the feeling of the possibility of doom was very much in the air, and I think it is again for all sorts of reasons. So yeah, I mean there are lots of parallels between then and now.
And yet, it's still a long game. It's not over.
From your mouth to God's ear, Francesca, really.
Well, Francine Prose, it's just been great to talk with you about this wonderful book, 1974, A Personal History.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Francine Prose. Listen to or read a sample from 1974 by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, Gail Godwin's meditation on something every single one of us faces, sooner or later. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to find more great content, including web-only features like interview transcripts and extended interviews. The movie director Ingmar Bergman once said that an artist should always have one work between himself and death. When renowned author Gail Godwin tripped and broke her neck while watering the dogwood tree in her garden at age 85, a lifetime of writing and publishing behind her, Bergman's idea quickly unfurled in front of her, forcing her to confront a creative life interrupted. In Getting to Know Death, Godwin shares what spoke to her while she was in a desperate place. Remembering those she's loved and survived, including a brother and father lost to suicide, and finding meaning in the encounter she has with other patients as she heals, Godwin takes stock of a life toward the end of its long arc, finding her path through the words she's written and the people she's loved. Gail Godwin is a three-time National Book Award finalist and the best-selling author of 12 novels. Gail Godwin, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much.
This meditation, as you call it, Getting to Know Death, you began it on August 10th, 2022. Tell us what precipitated this memoir in a way.
Well, let's see. On June the 6th of that year, 2022, I was starting to water a new little dogwood tree, and I tripped and fell on the gravel and broke my neck. So then I had to get to the house because I was on the ground and I couldn't get up. So I had to walk on my butt to the house, and it took a while. And then I got inside and punched 911, and they came. And I went to the hospital, and the surgeon, the neurosurgeon, said, "I'm the neurosurgeon. You have too many issues for surgery. So we're going to see if it will heal by itself." So it didn't. So 7 months later, I was sent to Westchester Hospital and had it stapled together again. And then I came home and I decided to just write how it felt to fall. And the best way I could do it was to write it in the second person. You turned on the spigot, you did this, you did that, and then you felt like you were falling and you fell. And then I had a lot more time to get through before next spring came and I got surgery. So I wrote most of this while I was waiting for the neurosurgeon said it might heal, it might not. You're old, but some things, it could work. It didn't work. And then I just started putting in things about death. I loved Christopher Hitchens. One of the last things he said was, live dyingly. And I thought, wow, that is good. We're going to live dyingly. And then I went back to the first person and started talking about how Robert, that's my late partner, liked to quote Ingmar Bergman, who said, an artist must always keep one work between himself and death. And then I began writing about my best friend, Pat, my age, who had just died, and told some of her story, and then got back to the present tense. And that's how the book is written, really. It's present tense. I'm waiting, 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 and remembering things about death.
You had actually broken bones before, as most of us have at one time or another in our life. Why was this incident the one that moved you to see it as part of a, moved you to begin contemplating death?
Well, to be truthful, I've been contemplating it for a long time, but this was like having it say, here I am, get used to it. And I've never been seriously sick, and I've never broken anything but my feet and a lower back once. And this was saying, you too are mortal. And I wanted to think about that more than anything else.
And why did you want to do that? Why did you want to think about that more than anything else?
Well, because I thought it just might happen any day. And I just prepared for it mentally and wrote these notes.
Yeah, you know, I took care of my mother for the last years of her life. I noticed how with her, you know, when she began to talk about death and think about it a lot, I remember once she asked me, she said, I don't know how to die. She says, I just don't know how to.
Did you have a good answer?
Well, I just kind of said to her, I said, you know, Mom, none of us gets out of this alive, and I'm sure that when the time comes, you'll do fine. And she did. She really did.
Did she?
Yes.
Oh, good.
I think she had a very good death. But, you know, it just came to me then how it was something, that sense of how do we cross over that boundary? So I found this book very, very interesting in the way that you approach the different deaths that you've experienced in your life, because it's not just yours, as you talk about your best friend, Pat, that's one person, but also you go back to your brother who took his own life at age 28 in a very shocking manner. So I wonder if you could talk about, well, about him and what happened, but also, you know, the difference when somebody dies when they're young versus those of us who are approaching, you know, that event horizon in a more natural way.
Well, my father actually took his life earlier than my brother. My father was 52, but I'll start with my brother. He was 28, and I've told this story in the book. He really wanted to be the savior. He wanted more than anything to be a highway patrolman, so the highway patrolman who he visited almost every day said, go to college first and then think. So he went and became an accountant and got a job working in an accounting firm. And he said, this isn't working out. He said, I want to catch the cheaters. So he had just applied for the IRS. And then he and his wife broke up, and he was left with the little boy of 3 years old. And he had to move back in with mother and father. And then he met a nurse who had been in the army. She knew how to shoot. And they made out a list of expenses, and they decided they would marry. And then at the last minute, she said, "You're too up and down. I can't take this." And she broke off with him. And so this was the afternoon after my mother's birthday. My brother ironed a shirt, put it on, and said, "I'm going off to settle this, and I'll be back one way or the other." And off he went. And the next thing I knew, my mother was calling me from the hospital. And I said, "What is it? Are you?" Because she had a heart condition. "What is it?" She said, "It's Tommy." And I said, "Oh, what has he done now?" And she said, "Tommy's gone," in this little high voice. And that was that. It turned out that he and his former fiance had gone off in a car and argued. And a boy riding a bicycle saw them arguing, and he saw her fall out of the car. He heard a shot, saw her fall out of the car, and heard another shot, and saw him go out on his side. And the next morning, the headline just read, "Couple found shot."
It must have been, I mean, obviously such a shock. You know, and in some way, the way you write about it, it's not quite clear. I had to think to myself, was this a murder-suicide? Who killed whom?
I think he killed her. I think from the boy on the bicycle, he said he heard a shot and then she fell out of the car. And then he heard another shot and he went out on his side. So my stepfather was so distraught. He hired a detective. He went over and over and over the detective's, the police knows, and then the detective knows, and we still don't know. But they're both gone.
And you said that there were four times in your life when you found yourself in a very desperate place, as you call it, which I took to as contemplating suicide, and that age 18 was the worst. So, again, not to move around, but to draw a thread between the appearance of death at different times in your life and how you dealt with it. Could you talk a little bit more about your own feelings when you were desperate? Because I think, you know, there are times when I thought that I just want to end it all, but I wouldn't do it, you know. So I don't draw a parallel between my thoughts and someone who is really much more serious about thinking about ending their life.
Well, I was, I just turned 18, and I was living in an apartment settlement. My stepfather got fired a lot, so he had many new jobs. And so we were living in Glen Burnie, Maryland, and I just graduated from my sixth high school because I'd been moved so many times. And I got a letter from my mentor, Mother Winters, from St. Genevieve's. And she made a list. She said, "Pat is going to Duke, and Lee and Stuart are going to St. Mary's, and Carolyn is going to Radcliffe, and where are you going?" And I remember sitting cross-legged on the bed, and I put the letter down, and I couldn't think of any way forward. I just thought, this may be my life. I'm not going to get what I wanted in it. And things are not necessarily going to get better. And then I had invited my father, who I had not seen since I was very small. I invited him to my high school graduation, and he showed up. He showed up with his new wife and his brother. And we liked each other, and so he started to write me. He said, "I would love more than anything to get to know you. You think we could maybe spend some time at the beach?" And so I went to join him at the beach. And to make a long story short, we really were so delighted to have found each other. He found out I was not happy. I did not tell him all. But he offered to send me to junior college in a place called Peace College in Raleigh, North Carolina. And he did. Then he sent me, by then I had a scholarship. I went to Chapel Hill. And my first year at Chapel Hill, he committed suicide.
That's extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. And, but the very end of this was that when he came in to my graduation and then when we met at the beach, he said, you know, I feel so good about this. I look at you and I think I've done something. And he said, and then when I started to write you, I thought to myself, maybe I'll be her rescuer. And he was.
And he was your rescuer, and yet he couldn't really rescue himself.
He couldn't. He'd been going down a long time. No, he couldn't. He couldn't.
So, you know, it's such a difference, you know, when somebody dies before their time to when somebody has had a whole lifetime to kind of get used to it. Tell us about your friend Pat, because she seems to have been quite a wise being.
What a wise being. Well, we were the same age. We even had our birthdays together some years because we were both born in June. And we first started talking about what we were going to be like when we got old, how we were going to keep our power. And then we got old and we decided we were eager to take up the subject of death. And we both said, well, when things get really bad, I'll have a way out. And she said, I'll have a way out too. And she really had amassed all these pills and things. I could not yet because my Robert was, he was older than me and he already had two life shorteners. Like he had heart condition and multiple myeloma. So I had to wait and didn't think of it. And then she didn't die until about 2 years before I wrote this book. And the way this happened was she just got tired and she thought, I'm going to do this. And she got out all of her stuff and she couldn't do it. She wrote a poem about it. I didn't write the poem in the book, but it has three stanzas. And the first stanza, she's 11 and she's climbing the diving board to the high board, the ladder to the high board. And she gets up there and she looks down and then she climbs back down. And then when she was 40, she was climbing up to the Eiffel Tower and she was almost to the top and she realized she had to go back down. So she was going back down backwards saying, pardon, pardon, pardon. And then the third stanza said, I asked for help and now I have to learn to climb down into my own death. And then after that, she decided she'd been giving away her money for years. And so she deeded over her house to the person who cleaned for her. And she called the ambulance and her friends and her sister and the ambulance took her to this nice nursing home. And she lived there for two years. I've left out the most important thing. After that, she wrote to me and she said, I'm now finally on Medicare. I've given away everything. I have two nightgowns. And so she lived that way for 2 years. And we kept saying, you should have a private room. And three of us got together and we thought, if we each pay $9,000 a year, we can afford it. She said, no. I was born at the top end. I want to see how it lives down at the other. And we said, well, at least let us give you an iPad or something, iPhone. No, she didn't want that either. So she lived 2 years like that in this place. And luckily, she was such a good teacher. She had two faithful former college students, and they visited her and saw that she had everything she needed, including when she was pretty far gone. One of the students was told, she still has some money and you have to spend it on her. And so he went and bought her tombstone. It's quite beautiful. And paid for the plot. And then she was buried there. She's always been very brave, more than the rest of us. When we were about 11, we were uptown waiting for our second bus, and there were two fountains. There was one that said colored, and the other said white. And I said, Anna's mother said if we drank out of the colored, that we would turn colored. And she said, how ignorant. So she marched over to the colored fountain and drank deeply, and then turned around and smiled and said, how do I look? That's sort of what she was like.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm talking with writer Gail Godwin about her new book, Getting to Know Death, A Meditation. So she was a teacher. You also taught. You were a three-time National Book Award finalist. There are a lot of literary connections and references in the book that pepper this meditation. Talk a little bit about some of the inspirations. Who did you derive inspiration from among the literary canon that you have studied and that you've taught in writing this book about getting to know death?
Well, first I started off with a poem I knew by Philip Larkin, and it's a three stanza long poem about how you're going to have to get ready for death. And then Henry James was also very interested in death. And for years, I had heard that the last words he said was, he fell on the floor and he said, here is at last the tremendous thing, the distinguished thing. And then I found that he did not say that at all. What he did was he was writing his niece the week before, and then he had a stroke, and then he fell on the floor, then he got up, and he met the woman who was going to take dictation for him that day, and he said, well, I almost died last night, and then I woke up, and I said, here it is at last, the distinguished thing. So that got to me, and you know, and then there's Tolstoy, who ran away to escape his wife's nagging, and he got to the train station and he had to die there. So there were a lot of those, especially about writers and by writers, about the great trip.
So now that you have complete, have you continued to write or keep notes about this? Because after all, until one actually gets there to that place, one doesn't forget that one is approaching it. Have you continued to work with this?
No. After that, I started another book. I started it last November, and I will finish it the day after the election. And this book is called The Art of Becoming a Citizen. And that's just what it's about. So I don't know how it's going to end, but it will end sometime in November, and we'll see what happens.
Yes, we will. Well, I hope that enough of us know enough about being a citizen that we don't lose our democracy.
So do I.
Gail Godwin's book, Getting to Know Death, is out from Bloomsbury Press. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.